श्री चैतन्यमनुभिस्तम्स्थापितं येन भूतले
स्वयं रूपकदा मह्यं दधाति शततां। Well, I didn't write the whole book. I'm just one of the contributors. I have a chapter here. But it's an interesting chapter because it deals with the story of a young girl, a child, who apparently remembered a previous life. And I wonder if we need to shift over a little bit so that anyone who wants to come later will be easy to accommodate. This was one of several, well, it came to more than 1,000 cases, investigated by a doctor, medical doctor, psychiatrist from America, of children who spontaneously, at a very young age, began to speak about a previous life. And in some of the cases, in fact, the person whose life they remembered was identified, and so many corresponding details were found to be true. They remembered places and people and incidents and where something had been kept. A lot more could be said about these cases. Some of them are fascinating. But apart from that scientific research, in the Bhagavad Gita, you've heard of Bhagavad Gita now? We're early in the year, right? The Bhagavad Gita is the chief book of Vedic wisdom. There it is, right behind you there. Maybe, well, it can come up to the front. Yeah. Pass that up. This is Bhagavad Gita, it's the main book of Vedic wisdom, wisdom which has been handed down for thousands of years in India. And from the Bhagavad Gita, from the very beginning, it's understood that this one life isn't everything. The author of this Bhagavad Gita as it is, the translator and commentator, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, gives the example of a horse. You have a horse that runs by the window. Of course, we're a couple flights up, but if you're on the ground floor, horse runs by the window. So you don't see it, and then you see it. And then you don't see it anymore. Now, should we therefore think that the horse came into existence when I began to see it, and when I no longer see it, it doesn't exist anymore? That doesn't make sense, right? It existed before, it'll exist after. But it's only in my field of vision for some time. But before it came into my vision, it was somewhere, and after it leaves my vision, it'll be somewhere. And now I see where it is for some brief time. So the Bhagavad Gita says that our lifetime is like that. First you see me, first you don't see me, then you see me, then you don't see me anymore. Right? Before we're born, we're unseen. Then we're born and everything happens and we're on the scene. And then we die and we're gone. We're not seen anymore. But the Bhagavad Gita says it's not that we sprang into existence at the time of birth, nor that we cease to exist at the time of death. The body is like that. It's born, that's the beginning of the body. It dies, that's the end of the body. But consciousness, or the self within, or the soul, it's not like that. It's eternal. It can't be created by material means. It can't be destroyed by material means. You can't cut it or drown it or burn it. Do anything to destroy it, because it's not material, it's spiritual. So, but we see it, we see the, that's the source of the life in the body. When consciousness leaves the body's dead. But we see a person only for some time, while he's in the body. But the Bhagavad Gita says, we've had many, many lifetimes. Innumerable lifetimes, and we're traveling from body to body. We're traveling from body to body. Even in this one lifetime, we're traveling from body to body. We had a child's body, and we get a young person's body, we get an old person's body. They're actually different bodies. You say, no, it's the same. It's not. You know, a million rand for anyone who can show me their baby's body. It's gone. It's gone. Scientists say every, 9 years, you've changed all the cells in your body. It's a completely different thing. So we're changing even in this life from body to body to body to body. And the Bhagavad Gita says death is another change of body. The soul stays in the body for some time, then he's transferred to another destination. And then birth takes place again. The soul's transferred at the time of conception to the new body. So and this explains a lot. Why is one person born in South Africa, another person born in Alaska, another person born in another part of the world? Why is someone born in a rich family, someone born in a poor family? Why is someone born healthy, someone born diseased? Why does a healthy person all of a sudden get stricken by some disease for no apparent reason, or get hit by a truck, or inherit $1 million? Just out of the blue, we say. But why are these things going on? No reason. But nothing happens for no reason. Everything happens for some reason. And when we don't know the reason, we say, well, by chance. Which is a non-explanation. Doesn't tell us anything. Everything has a reason. Apples don't fall from trees by chance. Nothing happens by chance. Everything happens for a reason. So the Bhagavad Gita says that the reason is my previous birth. You've heard of karma? Mm-hmm. What is karma? What does karma mean to you?
Things and contradictions.
Tell me.
What goes around comes back on.
What goes around comes back on, right? Okay. Yeah. You do something and then it comes back for you. We see that even in this life. You punch someone, he punches you back. Or you do some good deed and the good comes back to you. So the Bhagavad Gita says that this goes on not only for one life, but for many lives. So the person who was a thief in the previous life may get his money stolen in this life. The person who was generous in the previous life may be the object of generosity in the next life. And especially the person who cultivated some spiritual understanding in the previous life becomes attracted to spiritual understanding in the next life. Because in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that whatever we do is finished at the time of death, or whatever we accumulate, I should say. We get some money, it's gone. You become a professor, your degree is taken away. The child isn't born with the assets of the previous life intact. That may all be lost. But our karma, and especially our spiritual credit, is not lost. The karma stays with us, good or bad. And the spiritual advancement stays with us. So suppose you made 50% advancement on the spiritual path in your previous life. In the next life, you start from 50% or 51%. And you can continue. Materially, you build up a fortune. Next life, you have to start all over again. But spiritually, whatever you've gotten, that's your permanent credit. So, therefore, some people are more attracted. You know, we have a bhakti yoga society. I see a dozen or two dozen people. And I don't know how many students there are in the school, but must certainly a few thousand, I guess. So out of a few thousand, a couple dozen. Why this couple dozen? Why not so many more? But a couple dozen are more attracted to spiritual topics. Oh, they're going to be talking about some spiritual thing. They're going to be talking about something that elevates your life, brings you to a higher platform. So you're naturally attracted, and someone else is naturally, nah, not interested. Not my thing. Because they don't have the same spiritual credit. Maybe in this life they'll get some more. And some future point they'll say, okay, hey, really? And in this life, it's our opportunity that we can cultivate that spiritual attraction and make more progress up to the point of spiritual perfection. And freedom from, this is a cycle going around in birth and death, life after life. And each time, birth, death, birth and death, birth and death. And where does it go? It just goes to another round of birth and death. But by spiritual advancement, by bhakti yoga, we can get free from this cycle of birth and death and return to our natural relationship with God and return to the spiritual world where there is no birth and death. That's the summary of things. That's the summary of things. The cycle of birth and death is such that it's not even guaranteed that we'll have a human life. There's so many spiders and dogs and birds and fish. Where are they coming from? They're living beings. Where is their life coming from? The Bhagavad Gita says the soul is traveling through all these different species till finally it comes to the human form. Then the human form is our opportunity for further spiritual advancement. If we use that opportunity, we can be elevated to perfection. If we misuse the opportunity, we can go down again, not just as punishment, because that's what we want. If someone lives like a dog, he's creating the consciousness of a dog. You know, barking at people all the time. Don't bark at me. He's already a dog. The next life he takes the body of a dog. Nature says, okay, he's a dog in his head. Give him a dog's body. Because it's the consciousness that we create in this life that brings us to our next life. Whatever consciousness you create culminates at the time of death, and that consciousness becomes like the launch pad to the next life. If it's elevated consciousness or Krishna consciousness, it gives us freedom. If it's dog consciousness, pig consciousness, you see a person sometimes, that guy's a pig. He eats like a pig and lives like a pig. A pig. Next life, he may literally be a pig. He has a pig consciousness. Because I'm not this body, I'm the soul. The body's a dress. I may have a white dress, a black dress, a tall dress, a short dress, or this dress, or that dress. So I may be a human dress, it may be a bird dress, a tree bird dress, plant, fish, bird, and so many. The dress is changing. The dress is temporary. I have a child's dress, young person's dress, get an old person's dress. The body is a dress. But it's not a very happy dress because the dress is uncomfortable. The dress gives us problems. The body gives us problems, right? So we're meant to have a spiritual dress or a spiritual form, which one gets in the spiritual world. There's a material world, which is temporary, and the body is temporary. It belongs to this material world. But if the soul is eternal, it has to have an eternal place to live. That's the spiritual world. I'm going to stop here and see what kind of questions you might have. I saw a pad going around. Okay, there's a question getting written out. And when it's written out, we'll see what there is. Does this make sense to you? That's my question. Does this seem to make sense? No? Okay. Good. We have some more questions to answer. Yeah, you don't have to wait for the pad. You can ask a question straight out.
Let me ask one now.
Okay, ask one.
Yeah. Why do you think there's so resistance to the notion of reincarnation?
Why is there resistance to the notion of reincarnation?
Yeah, because I believe that it was there. Some people have it, some people don't. But
say it again.
No, to just answer that.
Okay. I think it's unfamiliar to us, and even it's against our some teachings. Sometimes we're told there's just one life, and that's it. So we say, oh, no, there's just one life. But if we don't examine it. A lot of notions, I mean, so many notions that today are accepted as scientific facts, were all resisted vigorously. Before, for almost any scientific knowledge, at first it gets resisted because we have our old way of looking at it. Right? We have our old way of looking at it. And then finally it becomes persuasive. Yes, actually, it's right. Okay, is that clipboard, did it clip my way? Okay, there's still more questions there. Any more live questions? Yeah.
How? I don't know, I'm just trying to understand how you say, okay, sometimes you do realize that, okay, this person acts and thinks like, and does things like a dog, maybe in the next lifetime they will be a dog, but what evidence is there to that?
What evidence is there? Well, you have the evidence even in this life that a person becomes, what do you say? We create our future. Someone goes to college and creates a bright future for himself because of the consciousness that he develops, the knowledge that he develops, the skills that he develops. He creates his future. And someone else is, you know, living on the street and taking drugs and stealing cars, and he's creating a future for himself. Maybe he's going to live in jail. Right? We create our future. Everything we do has a result. It creates a future. So if our future ends with the body, okay, that's it. You have no future. When the body dies, you're dead, and that's it. But if there's a future, if death is not the end, what creates that future? What determines that future? What sort of future will it be? What does that depend on? Depends on what you did in this life, right? Does that make sense?
To be honest.
So okay.
Can I just paraphrase? Not paraphrase, but just. It relates to my first question, but doesn't it have implications on this issue of, you know, some people believe in heaven, some people believe in hell. So you create your future, you go to heaven.
Okay.
Or hell.
So, but now, so we're looking at that as the alternative explanation.
Sure.
There's one life, and then you go to heaven or you go to hell.
What I don't understand about heaven and hell as well is, yes, you die, but
believe that we will all be judged when Jesus comes, the whole shebang. Now, what I'm, in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, the souls that are dead now, where are they?
Yeah,
because there's instances where people say they see ghosts. I've never seen a ghost, so I'm not one to judge. But I'm just saying, are they ghosts? What are they doing? Who gets to be a ghost? You know? Like, who gets to go to heaven? Where are they?
Okay, good question. You know, if it's like, you know, we all die until, and we sort of hang out till sometime when Jesus comes and, as you said, the whole shebang. Where are we till then?
Yeah.
Are we just like sort of in a warehouse somewhere and, in cold storage?
We,
or
we, what do you mean?
We have left our bodies on earth.
Yeah, the bodies are gone. You know, we know that, dust to dust. But where? What about me? What about the soul? Where am I? And that's not really answered in the Bible. That's not really answered by the sort of general idea that, well, you die and then sometime in the future you're resurrected. You know, where are we till then? The Bhagavad Gita answers that and says it's not that you're ever like nowhere. But you leave this life, you go to the next life. You leave college, you go to grad school, or you go to the job market. You left grade school, you came to college. You leave one situation, you go. You move out of an apartment, you move to the next apartment or to a house. So you're always somewhere, you're never nowhere. And it's always on account of you left this apartment, you got a better apartment because you got a better job and you got more money. Or you lost that apartment, you went to a lower apartment because you couldn't get a job and you hardly had any money and you had to scrape by. According to your what's in your pocket, you get your next apartment. So according to your spiritual credit or the credit of your activities from this life, you get your next life. Maybe higher if you have more credit, lower if you have less credit. And we go on and on like that. Make sense? Yeah.
I'd like to know that, like, when will this, like, we end? When will we end?
When do we end?
When will it end? Yeah, like,
when does this cycle end?
Yeah, cycle end.
It ends when you go back to God. Otherwise, it never ends.
Okay, so you mean like if I die maybe today, maybe I become a dog.
You become a dog.
And
okay.
Then after, and then when
we don't wish it on you, but okay.
I die again.
The dog goes to heaven.
Yeah. Suppose I die and I become a dog. So the dog is also going to have to die. But the trouble with being a dog is the dog can't say, you know, here I am as a dog. Why am I wasting my life as a dog? I could be a professor. I could be a, you know, something. I could make something of myself. I could study spiritual literature and elevate my consciousness instead of barking at cars going by. I could be reciting mantras. The dog can't think that way because he's a dog. The dogs and cats and the lower creatures don't have the developed consciousness that we have. And we have developed, as human beings, we have developed consciousness. And what does that mean? It means that we can think about these kind of questions. Why am I here? What's the purpose in my life? What happens at the time of death? Where did I come from? Where am I going? How can I get out of this, the miseries that life here imposes on us? These are all the questions for a human being. So the human beings, human life provides the opportunity for elevation. The lower creatures, the way the laws of nature work, are elevated one tiny baby step at a time. So one species of dog may next life be the little better species of dog. You know, there are gradations even in that life. Like we see in India, there are monkeys. Some of them are just like, you know, just troublemaking sort of monkeys. There's certain species like that. And some of them are more like gentlemen.
Gentlemen.
Yeah, yeah, really. They're you can see they're, right? The langurs, they're little gentlemen. So, you know, then next species up, next species up, next species up, next species up for thousands of species. And that means thousands and thousands of lifetimes. Then we get a human life. That's what we've got. After thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of lifetimes, gradually coming up, finally we've made it. We've got the human form of life. And now if I use it to live like a pig, again, down in thousands of lives before I get the opportunity again. So the Vedic sages urge us, don't waste the human form of life. It only lasts a short time. And it gives the greatest value if we take it. We should grab this opportunity. Okay, here's some clipboard questions. How important is it to practice spiritual life in this human body? Well, we just answered that, didn't we? This is my opportunity to go up, to get freedom, or it's my opportunity to go down. So if I practice spiritual life through one means or another, I can be elevated. And if I just like use it for the animal life, what's animal life? Animal life means, what do the animals do? They eat, they sleep, they have sex, and they fight. They defend themselves. That's what animals do. They don't philosophize. They don't seek spiritual advancement. That's for the human beings. And the human beings also. We eat, we sleep, we have sex, we defend ourselves. But that's not all we do. We ask these questions. Why am I here? What is the purpose of my life? That makes us human beings. Otherwise, in the Vedic language, we're two-legged animals. You know, if we don't inquire about spiritual life, we're animals with two legs, that's all. They say man is the rational animal. If we're not rational, then we're just animals. So, crucial, very important. How does the Bhagavad Gita count how many species one will move until reaching the human life? Well, the Bhagavad Gita doesn't really count. It just says, it's up to you. It can be in one life. In one life, if you fix your mind, you can attain perfection. Or someone's, you know, like school, someone's very serious and they, you know, graduate early, or they graduate with honors. And someone, you know, takes them like 8 years to graduate. Not so, you know, mine's elsewhere. So it's up to us, but the Bhagavad, other books, not the Bhagavad Gita, but related books, give us this list that there's so many. There's so many animals, there's so many trees and plants, there's so many aquatics, there's so many birds, and it comes to millions, 8 million, the number is 8,400,000. And you can figure that way, how many thousands and thousands and thousands of insects there are, how many reptiles there are. How many birds there are? Thousands and thousands and thousands of species. Millions. And we can go step by step by step by step through millions of lifetimes. Hmm? This is the opportunity, the human life. Does the Bhagavad Gita suggest that reincarnation is true? It just outright says this, it is. Yes. Do you believe psychic mediums? If not, why? People who can speak to the dead. These things are there. These things are there. There's all sorts of... The world is spooky. It's not as cut and dried as people might like to believe. So there are... You were asking about ghosts before. There are ghosts. What's a ghost? Somebody you don't want to meet on a on a Monday evening. The Vedic literature tells us that we have two bodies. The physical body that you can see, and then the mental body. Your mind, your intelligence. That's like another body, like a subtle body. You know, even if my hands are tied and I can't move, still my mind is moving. So that's like another covering of myself. There's my spiritual self, my eternal self. Then there's the subtle covering of mind. And then there's the grosser covering, this body. Just like I might be wearing a shirt and a coat. So we're covered by the mind, and then by the grosser body, the physical body. So the Bhagavad Gita, or the Vedic literature, says that a ghost is a soul that doesn't have this physical body that we see. It only has the subtle body. Only the mind and the thoughts, but not the, you know, like having a shirt but not a coat. It doesn't have a gross body, it only has the subtle body. How does one become a ghost? There are different ways. Suppose someone kills himself. So nature says, okay, you didn't want the physical body, or you destroyed the one I gave you, I'm not going to give you another one. You know, you ripped up your coat, I'm not going to give you a new coat. So then you're stuck. You only have the subtle body and not the gross body. You have thoughts and feelings and desires, but you don't have a body to act them out with. That's a ghost. And that's a miserable kind of life. You have all kinds of thoughts and feelings and desires, and no medium with which to satisfy those desires. Therefore, the ghosts are become mad or try to latch on to someone else and enjoy through his body. Well, that's a troublesome kind of life. Then what happens?
I'm trying to, like you mentioned that the ghost, the trouble, so sometimes they try to latch on to...
Yeah, try and latch on to us.
Yeah.
Here's a nice body, I could, you know, possess this one and...
So they kind of come to us in the form of demonic spirits? Or?
Yeah, they can, you know, they come to you and haunt you or try to get you to do something... crazy. Yeah, they try to take over. And we see that. We see the people, you know, they're like normal people, but then they're as if possessed. And Vedic literature accepts that, yes, they're possessed. And then you get these people who want to communicate with the dead. What's the benefit of communicating with the dead? It's better to communicate with the living. But, you know, they're intrigued. Let me communicate with the dead. Let me commune with the dead. It's risky business. They could become like the people they're talking to. Right? And that's what happens. You know, we become like the people we hang out with. You know, they're scholars. We become a scholar. They're drug addicts. We become drug addicts. They're ghosts. We can become like that. Ghosts may not be the kind of people you want to talk to.
Well, this issue doesn't relate to the whole thing of people. You know, lately there's a lot of ghost movies. You know, you have a lot of vampire movies. You know,
There's ghost movies, vampire movies, so, Godzilla movies. I mean, there's so many movies, but there's something underneath it.
It's a curiosity.
I mean, it's interesting that you find this in. You know, they believe in ghosts in Greek culture, they believed in ghosts in Roman culture, the Egyptians believed in ghosts, the Mayans believe in ghosts, in India they believe in ghosts. You know, why is this all over the world? Africa. Because there's something there. Now, we may not get it 100% straight from the movies, but when we study these things from Bhagavad Gita, we actually get a clear understanding. And the soul is traveling, and sometimes it gets trapped in that situation. Ghost. Yeah, I mean, heaven and hell you experience even on earth.
Yes.
Right? I mean, right. These days, like if you go to a place like maybe Iraq, it's hell. You know, the Americans will drop bombs on your home and you know, all sorts of things. You know, you can't get proper drinking water and you don't know when soldiers are going to attack you. But we had the Vietnam War when, you know, it was hell for people. Burn your village. Or, you know, like Saharan parts of Africa where there's no water and there's no food sometimes and people are starving. It's as good as hell. And then there's like places where there's you've got money and you've got the ocean and you've got great standard of living and you've got whatever you want. It's like heaven. So even in this life we experience there's heaven. There's hell. There's all sorts of gradations. So the Vedic literature says there are different parts of the universe where there are hellish regions. And there are other parts of the universe where there are heavenly regions. And you can go. But if you go to these heavenly regions, it's like I just came from Mauritius. I was there for a week. I was there for some work. But so many people go there on holiday. Especially from France, they come to Mauritius because it's freezing in France right now. They go down to Mauritius and it's beautiful and the sun is shining. And they stay for a week and then they have to go back because they use up their money and they have to go back to work. They can't stay. So it's like they went to heaven for a week. Then they go back to hell. They used up their credit. So we earn some credit for being generous, for being kind, for being this. And maybe that means in your next life you can go to one of these higher planets, higher regions, a heavenly place. But then, in that cycle of birth and death, you come back down. Or it can go the other way. You do something mean and you go down to the lower part and it's hellish. But then you're using up your punishment, like going to prison. You know, every day that you're in prison is one day closer to being released. So they use up their bad karma and then they come back. So this is the place in the middle from which we can get free from going up and down, up and down, up and down. You can get out and go back to the spiritual destination. You had a question.
So the book, I don't know what it's called, but the book, it suggests that your soul moves from one body to another. So how is it possible that in some religions it's also proven that like when you die you become an ancestor, or like when you die your soul is waiting somewhere for God to release you to go to heaven or hell? Like you get psychic mediums, the people that can speak to the dead. They don't speak to ghosts, but like family members that have died, and like, you know. So I just want to know how that is possible and if it clashes with reincarnation.
Yeah. Well, there are two things. One thing is that not every medium is a real medium. You know, I'm talking to the dead, but really I'm talking to my mind. Or I'm just an outright cheater. there have been these exposés of you know, serious ones of people who seemed to be talking to the dead, and then you know, the trick was discovered, how they were cheating. There used to be all sorts of things, and you'd see these things flying through the air, and you know, the spirit would begin talking, and you'd hear this and hear that, and things would fly, and things would suddenly appear out of nowhere, and people would feel things touching them. You know, you've heard of seances. You know, people. They gather in a circle in a darkened room and wait for something to happen, and then the psychic says, "I feel something. Someone's trying to speak to us."
She's here.
He's here. Anthony, is that you? Then you hear this knocking. You know, and all sorts of spooky things happen. And scientists would, you know, investigate these things. And lots of times they'd find out the trick. You know, it was just like pure trickery. You know, I can get into all the details, but they'd just be exposed. Pure trick. Some of it sometimes is just a pure trick, or sometimes it's what we call psyching ourselves into something. You know, in my mind. It's all mental concoction. It can be that. Then maybe there's someone who actually is able to communicate with the departed spirit. Because the same thing, the horse is running by your window, you only see him when he's in front of the window. But before he was someplace else, after he's someplace else, so if you've got a special capability, you may be able to see the horse after I can't see it anymore. Well, these things are there. There's a large literature, actually, of serious investigation of psychic abilities with clairvoyance and the ability to see the future and the ability to envision what's in different places and the ability to know what another person is thinking. The ability to make things happen. I mean, you know, typical one is spoons bend because I want them to bend without my touching them. So a whole range of powers are there. In the yoga literature, they tell about, you know, superpowers, super powerful capabilities, the ability to become lighter than the lightest so that you can float, the ability to extend your hand to any part of the universe and take anything you want. The ability to, there's so many. They're called mystic powers. So they may be there. Maybe most of the cases are just cheating or self-deception. But there may be cases someone's actually communicating with departed spirits. In the Bible, I think there are instances someone's communicating with departed spirits, and there's a warning, don't do it.
But then how can somebody communicate with a dead spirit if somebody dies and moves on to being a dog or a bird or something?
Say it again?
I'm asking, how can somebody communicate with the dead spirit if the dead spirit has turned into a dog?
Good question.
And that cat cannot remember its past life.
Yeah, good question. It may not be possible. You know, you're trying to communicate with me, but I'm in the body of a dog somewhere. I'm not communicating. Except woof, woof, woof. So it limits the range of who we can communicate with. The ghosts I can communicate with if I have the ability, because they're still around and doing something. But they're in a shadowy region. They're in to be in touch with them is not great. And they may not even be trustworthy. You know, they say this is happening, that's happening. And it could be laughing up their sleeve, you know. Fool that guy. The communication with the dead is generally considered unreliable. We don't know when it's real communication and when it's not. And inadvisable. Better to communicate with the living, and especially with those who are spiritually advanced. You know, what will the dead tell us? Best case, what is a dead person going to tell me?
Okay, this raises a very, very crucial question. Mm. In Africa, where most cult traditions in Africa, including where I come from, Swazi, Zulu. I'm half Swazi, Zulu.
Half Swazi?
Zulu. It's the same thing, basically.
Yeah, okay.
I consider it the same thing. We believe in ancestors.
Yeah.
Now, ancestors, we don't really consider them dead.
Right.
So I don't know if this has any relation with the whole issue of the fact that we know that they're without body. They've mm-hmm. lost their body. So mm-hmm. we don't talk to their body.
Right.
We don't even go to the grave. Mm-hmm. Well, according to original African culture, we don't go to the grave. And there's something after a particular, after certain days, you go to the grave and you do a certain ritual mm-hmm. called Buyisa. Mm-hmm. So you do this ritual, which basically returns the person's soul mm-hmm. to a place where they would be comfortable in, maybe it's their right. home. Right. But you know you're not returning the ghost. You're not right. taking a ghost from the grave. You're going to where you've planted him. We say, you've been planted. So we plant the person, but then we bring their soul back to a comfortable place. I think in the Egyptian literature, it's something they do something like that too. Yeah. But just to cut a long story short, our ancestors, we have different grades of the god, mm-hmm. of the god principle. There is Umenzi, which is the creator, mm-hmm. Whom I'm named after. But anyway, there's Umenzi, there's Nomkhubulwane, there's Nomhoi, there's Nkulunkulu, there's Mvelinqangi. Mvelinqangi is kind of like Adam. It's the first great, 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 great being, basically progenitor of all of us. Mm. But now the ancestors, we consider them to be kind of like mediums, mm-hmm. not the living medium, but
yeah.
the medium. When we pray, according to Zulu culture, you don't talk to Mvelinqangi and say, "Oh, Mvelinqangi, I would like to pass my exam." Mm. You go to your elder at home or whoever, and they speak on your behalf, or you go and you to do something called a pash. Mm-hmm. You speak in a place called Msang. Sorry to take long, I'll be quick.
That's okay.
You go to a place, you burn incense, mm-hmm. sage usually. You use sage. And you go to a place, usually a place, like my surname again. My surname is Masebo. It means hearth. Now the hearth is a place where you go in a family setting where you go, it's like your altar. Mm-hmm. And you speak to the great, the ones you can remember. You mentioned their names, the ones you can remember, and you say, they must speak to Nkulunkulu. Now, Nkulunkulu is the one who communicates with the unseen, with Menzi, or Mveli, you know, basically the whole grade of gods. Mm. But you're speaking to the one through your ancestors. Mm. Some people say the ancestors are like the angels. Mm. You know, you're speaking to your ancestors. Because God is so great,
unreachable directly.
It doesn't care whether you're living, eating meat, or you're not eating meat, you're dying, or you're living. But the ancestors do. Mm. So on your behalf, the ancestors all speak, and then things happen. That's just the Zulu culture. So I'm asking the question quickly: How does that fit in into the whole issue of the reincarnation? Because we don't really consider like how many thousands of years or whatever. We just consider that we come from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that somewhere, those people know because they've experienced the past. Mm. I don't know, they've lived before. So. Mm.
Good.
I don't know, that's my question.
Now, to answer that question properly is going to take a long time because we have to study the whole thing and see where everything lies. So we're going to just
treat... It doesn't fit with the Vedas.
We'll just have to treat it in summary because you're giving a detailed sort of...
I'm saying African culture.
Don't be sorry, because it's interesting. But to answer in detail would take... I have to study it in detail, then I have to to speak in detail. So I'll just speak in a general outline. The first point is, in both conceptions, the ancestors are living. Mm. You know, suppose I become an ancestor, that means I die. Mm. But it's not that I'm dead.
Yes.
That I no longer exist.
Transferred.
I'm somewhere. I'm just not here. You know, the horse has run by the window and now he's, you know, two blocks down the road. But he's not non-existent.
You can call him back.
You can call him back, or you could catch up with him, or whatever it is. So that's the first thing. In neither conception do you just die and cease to exist. You go on living. That's point one. And okay, now we first thing is we want to pray that the ancestor gets a good spot.
Yes.
That's there in Vedic culture also. Actually, it's there probably in most cultures. A relative dies, and you pray that you'll get a good destination.
Yes.
Whether you think it's just heaven or hell, or whether you think there's
good journey in the other life.
Yeah, another life. So you're praying that, well, he's gone and I'm here, and my wish is that he'll get a better destination. That's there in Vedic culture also. And the rituals may be different, and the particulars may be, how we do things may be different, but the idea is there. This person did something for me. Actually, the Vedic literature says we're all indebted to our ancestors. Because on account of our ancestors, we have this life. My parents and their parents, and they've, on account of their efforts, we're here. So we're indebted to them. So at the time of their passing, we pray that they can get a better destination. And that's found in so many cultures all over the world. So that's the same. Now the next thing, praying to the ancestors. Now, it may be that the ancestors have a better spot. Especially if they've gone to if they haven't gone down, they've gone up, then we may seek their blessings.
Their guidance.
Their blessings, their guidance. We're looking for some, let's say blessings, that they're, just as if my father and mother are living, then when I graduate school, I ask for their blessings, that now I'm trying to advance further, or I'm getting married, I seek their blessings. Every culture, we seek the blessings of our superiors, because we think that by their blessings, I'll be able to make advancement. So in both cultures, in the Vedic culture, African culture, then we're seeking the blessings of those who came before us. We may not see them, we may not know exactly where they are, but we hope for their blessing, that they'll bless our endeavors, or that their good wishes will help us advance on our path. But they're whatever, that's there. But quite some similarities are there. It's not that the person's dead and that's it. The person's still there, and their blessings may help us, or our good wishes may help them. If they're stuck, in a lower region, then by our good wishes, they come up. So there's these ideas of wisdom are shared across cultures. But in the Bhagavad Gita, you find it given in a very scientific form.
So the difference is just the science.
Yeah, I mean, like a dictionary, you look in a small dictionary and you find the words. But you look in a big dictionary, you find more words, you find more definitions, you find where the word came from. It's not that the small dictionary is wrong, but the big dictionary gives you more. So this Bhagavad Gita is like a big dictionary. You'll find so much that you already may know, or that you sort of have an outline, but you find more knowledge. So this Bhagavad Gita is such an important book.
Thank you.
Thank you, thank you. Where am I? We want to take some more questions. My director is not here. Yeah.
It's not so much a question. Can I just tell you what I believe?
What is?
I believe that it all depends on how you think, really, and what you believe in. Because you find some people believe in the whole ancestral idea, and things actually happen. When they do talk to their ancestors, stuff actually happens. And you find that when a child is born, they have to slaughter an animal of some sort and have the whole ceremony done. And then you find that other people don't believe in that stuff. Like, let's say the family that does believe in it, if you don't do the ceremony for your child, something happens to your child. Like, in my mom's side of the family, they actually have to slaughter something, and the child, at a certain age, they have to get his pants. I'm not sure it is in English. So it's the traditional watch. It's a bracelet. You have to get one of these.
Okay, you got to get one of those.
You have to get one of those.
One of these.
One of my cousins didn't get it, and it's sort of, he was a normal child all along, and then the time came when he had to get it, and I don't know how they see, but my granny knows, like, it's time. She tells you, and then you have to do it. And then he didn't get it, because his dad was just out there doing his own thing. So now, he's not so much retarded, but he's not 100% anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then you find that my dad's side, they don't believe in that. They didn't believe in anything, and we were born, there never came a time when we needed to have anything done for us, and I'm going to say that we're fine.
Okay.
I'm just going to stick to that. I'm just going to say that we came out normal. We don't have to have a special, we don't have to
slaughter something
or do something.
Right.
We just believe in, okay, go to church and pray to your God. And we pray to God, and we see stuff happening, like miracles, like God actually, well, since I believe in God and that he has his angels watching over us, like when we do pray, sometimes we do see that, okay, we're being tested, but at the end of the day, like, it always comes through for us. Mm. And for the people that believe in their ancestors, they always come through for them. And so I think it's a matter of what do you believe in. It's in the mind. It's all in the mind. Because if I believe in Tokoloshes, I will start seeing them.
Yeah.
But since I don't see them.
Right.
And they don't bother me. They bother the people who believe in them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's all in the mind, really.
Okay, you think it's all in the mind. Let's say it's some in the mind. let's adjust that and say it's some in the mind. Because otherwise we get to a philosophy where everything is projected from my mind. Nothing exists except if I think it exists. Nothing happens unless I think it happens. Whatever I do think, if I have the power of strong thinking, does happen. And that's carrying things too far. Let's take, for a real strong example, death. Suppose I say to you, well, if you believe in it, that's okay for you, and you'll die, but I don't believe in it, so I'm not going to die. It's not part of my worldview. What do you think?
I guess you're correct. I get what you're saying, that if I don't believe in death, I'm not going to die. No, that's not going to happen. I will die eventually. My body will wither.
Yeah.
But my soul will come.
That's another thing. But suppose someone thinks, I won't die. My body, you know, I'm going to be just like this, and maybe I'll get a little older, but I'm not going to die. That's not going to happen. Right? It's not that, well, you can believe in death if you want to, but I don't believe in it, so death's not going to come for me.
It's against natural law.
It's natural law. Well, you know, you may believe in old age, but I don't believe in old age, so I'm not going to get old. You believe what you want, but old age is a law. We have to get old. We have to die. It's not that everything is just whatever we make it. Now, there's a certain extent to which you're right. You're right. You know, our collective consciousness creates certain expectations, and from that, things happen in a certain way. I mean, even, you know, in medicine, if you think you're going to die, chances are that you may, you know, head out pretty quick. And if you think that you, you know, there are instances, people, they thought they had a terminal condition and they died. And then it was found that they were okay, actually. It's just by thinking, you know, it happened. And if you're in a group and the group is thinking a certain way, you know, that can definitely change what happens to you. It can, you know, maybe even influences the environment so that things happen. You know, I gave the example that there's people who bend spoons, you know, just by the power of their mind. Mind is a powerful thing. So you get, you know, a room full of people trying to bend the spoon, and they're talented people, you know, the spoons may just... So you get, you know, people believing something and then it happens because they thought, yep, that's what would happen. So to a certain extent, yeah. But it's not absolute. It's not that whatever I think, that's what it is. But consciousness is powerful. The power, the what you think matters. And therefore in the Bhagavad Gita, it's made especially what you think of at the time of death. Determines your next direction. But thinking is so important. You know, we're trained in college, but are we trained to think in this way? You know, where am I going? What will my next life be? What should I think of? There's a story about a king. He was cursed, and he came to know, I have 7 days left to live. Yeah, cursed. 7 days left to live. So what did he do? Well, 7 days more, live it up. He went to a holy place, and he sat down there to think, what should I do? And different saintly people came. They came to know the king was going to die. And he asked them, that you're all saintly people, what should I do? I have 7 days left. What should I hear about? What should I think of? What should I remember? And he was advised, you think about God, you think about Krishna. Hear about Krishna. And he did that, and he became perfect. So that we're not taught. What should I think of? What should I remember? What's the ultimate goal? How do I reach that goal? We're just taught, you know, how to get a job, how to make some money. And that's good, you know, jobs and money count for something, but that's not what human life is for. There's more to that, more to life. So I think you're on to something there, that our thinking is so important. What we think of. What we think of. And in one sense, different spiritual traditions are approaching the same truth from different angles of vision. And you know about the elephant, and the different men were trying to understand what, there were these blind men, and they were trying to understand what an elephant was. The elephant was there, and one man grabbed the leg of the elephant. He said, well, the elephant's like a big pillar. Another grabbed the tail of the elephant and said, the elephant's like a broom. The other grabbed the trunk of the elephant and said it was like a snake. So all the different men had a different idea of what the elephant was, because they were approaching from different angle of vision. So to a certain extent, everyone's looking for God. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, everyone's looking for me, and they're coming at me from different approaches. Therefore we find in every country, in every culture, there's some spiritual dimension. And some people ignore it, but generally there's something spiritual. There's something higher. There's some greater truth. And it may be expressed in this way or expressed in that way. The art may show it this way or the art may show it that way. The rituals may be like this or the rituals may be like that. But there's that perception that there's something higher. Or there's God. There's eternal life. And it's seen from one way or another way. And so we discover some truth in so many traditions. There's so much truth to be found in spiritual traditions from all over the world. And the Bhagavad Gita, as I mentioned, gives a very scientific picture, or a very thorough picture, very clear picture. And when we look at different traditions, we can say, okay, I see how this fits. Whether it's African tradition or Christian tradition or Islam, if you look at it in an open sort of way, you can say, okay, I see how that fits. I see how this, I can understand from this perspective how this would be viewed. Is that good? Does that fit to some extent with what your thoughts were?
Yes, because no matter where you go, we all know that there is a higher God.
Yeah.
There is God. I might believe in Jesus, someone else might believe in Shambhu, other people might believe in Buddha, but at the end of the day, we have God, we just have different people who are saved by God.
Yeah.
In a way that we think.
And a lot of the things, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, it's okay. Actually, I was just extending on that I believe in Jesus. You know, I believe he came down and he died. And other people believe, some dude. I don't know. I'm so sorry, yeah. I'm not.
It'll be interesting, probably in another meeting, to talk about. You know, today we talked about reincarnation. There's also something called avatar. Have you heard that word, avatar?
Avatar.
Sometimes you hear about it in like social networking context, but avatar is a term that comes from the Bhagavad Gita. The concept comes from Bhagavad Gita, that God can descend to the world, or that God can send someone on his behalf to deliver a message. So that's very much a part of the Vedic culture or Vedic philosophy. And sometime we might talk about how Jesus is seen as the Son of God from the Vedic point of view, and how that idea of avatar sort of puts things in a perspective that makes sense. Very interesting, actually. This avatar idea, even, you know, well, I won't get into that, but there was a big controversy. Is Jesus man? Is Jesus God? Is he, you know,
both?
Or what is he? You know, the early Christians were asking themselves, they're actually like debating this question for hundreds of years. You know, he was here, what was he? Was he God? And so they say, no, if he's good. Some, one side said, no, if he was God, then you're denying his humanity and the sacrifice that he went through. Because if he was God, it was, you know, it didn't really happen in a true sense. And then the other side said, yeah, but if you say that he's man, you're denying his divinity. You're making him just an ordinary person like us. So there was big, you know, what to make of this. So the Vedic idea of avatar really provides a helpful way to see it, because in that picture, God can descend or God can send someone who's in one sense like him, who's not on our level, who's divine. And Jesus can fit in that, can be understood in that way, as being a divine messenger of God, as being one with God in a certain sense, and still being who he is as an individual, not being absolutely identical with God, but being, we could say, one and not one at the same time. That's another class. That's another meeting. But it's interesting to see how different worldviews can be harmonized through the Vedic picture, through the literature of yoga. And therefore we say it's not a religion. It's not that we're asking people, well, you're a Buddhist, become a Hindu, or you're a Christian, become a Hindu, or you're something else, you belong to an African religion, you give that up and become Hindu. No, it's not like that. It's not like you change from one religion to another religion, but you get knowledge, and you deepen your spiritual understanding, and you attain greater spiritual purification. And that can work for people of any religion. It's not that you have to switch. That's superficial, you know. I changed my passport, now I'm not an American anymore. Now I've become South African. Or a South African passport I put aside and I become Tanzanian or something. But that's superficial, because I'm not eternally American or eternally South African or eternally Tanzanian. I was born in America, so I'm an American. If I'd been born someplace else, I'd be something else. Maybe next life I'll be born in Tanzania and I'll be Tanzanian or South African or who knows. So I'm born in a certain family and then I become a Hindu or a Christian or this or that. And I'm brought up with, you know, in that culture. That's fine. That's fine. And if I switch from being a Christian to a Buddhist or from being a Buddhist to a Christian, that's fine too, but that's not eternal. It's not that if you go to the kingdom of God, you'll find that you know, there's signs, you know, Buddhists this way, and Christians that way. Pentecostalists, you're a little down the road, and the Seventh-day Adventists, okay, they're, follow the signs to the left, and then make a right at the first waterfall. And
seventh floor.
Well, it's not quite like that. These different spiritual paths are all trying to bring us to the same destination. Or they're all, you can say, yeah, they're all paths by which we can hope to reach the same destination. And that same destination can be very well appreciated. Whichever path I'm following, that supreme destination can be very much appreciated through this literature. And our approach can be helped by the chanting of this Maha Mantra. Because Krishna is a universal name of God. It's not like Krishna means the Hindu God. Krishna means God, that's all. All attractive. All attractive means you'll attract the Hindus, he'll attract the Christians, he'll attract the atheists, he'll attract white people, he'll attract black people, he'll attract anyone. All attractive. All attractive. So God is attractive for, regardless of what country, regardless of what religion, God has attractive qualities. Beauty, wisdom, renown. These are attractive qualities.
Yeah.
Right? Strength and power. Everyone's attracted to beauty. Everyone's attracted to wisdom, to fame, to strength. And God has all these things unlimitedly. So how could God not be attractive? So by chanting these mantras, we increase our attraction for God. We come closer to God, and we revive our relationship with God. And that's good for people of whatever country, whatever religion, doesn't matter. Tell me what to do. You're the leader, right? I have to take direction from you.
Okay. Do we have questions?
I have one more statement to her, though, not to me.
Okay.
No, just quickly. Let me say quickly. But for you, my sister, you know, I studied different kind of faiths, and there was a time when I was studying Hare Krishna in advance. I read the whole Bhagavad Gita twice, and I like it. But I found that in the Bhagavad Gita, I was finding it because I was raised a Christian. My parents are both ministers of the gospel of Christ. Now, for me, there was a time when I was studying Hare Krishna a lot, I found there were so much similarities between what Krishna was teaching and what Jesus was teaching. For me, I just found it that way, that's my perspective. I started believing that the word Krishna and Christ is the same thing, but I won't say it's the same, but I started believing that. But then also, I went back again then to studying the Bible. And in the Bible, I found so many references to reincarnation. Even though I found, when I went to my preacher, I said, do you believe in reincarnation? He says, absolutely not. These are things that Indians, it's an Indian thing. It's a Buddhist thing and what. We don't believe in it. But I was pointing it to him, scriptures. You know, have you heard of the word Melchizedek? Mm-hmm. Now Melchizedek is supposed to be Christ. And then Christ comes and says, I was there before Abraham. He says, I was there before Abraham. Mm-hmm. Right? Now Abraham, we know Abraham is ancient. But now, I found in the same thing that, for me, it was a reference to reincarnation. It's just that they don't use the word reincarnation. But I found it as him confirming that he has been there before Adam. So there's some part in the Bible that says Adam was there before Adam. So for me, I found it as being the same thing. So that's why I became more peaceful. I was like, there's no need for me to say the Bible is right, or that it's wrong, or the Hare Krishna is right, or it's wrong. I just found it as saying the same thing, but saying it in different languages. Mm. Yeah, Krishna, Melchizedek. Melchizedek was never, in the Bible, Gita says Krishna was never born. In the Bible, it says Melchizedek does not have a mother, does not have a father, but he's the king of Salem. Mm-hmm. He's the king. And some parts in the Quran, they talk about him having a wife, Melchizedek. They call him something else. But they also say he was never born. Yeah, that's it. That's what I wanted to say.
Okay, thank you.
So it's the same.
Thank you.
Okay. If like you don't have questions, then we stand for 5 minutes while they are preparing supper. And this book is on special. It's 60 rand.
20.
But today, it's 70 rand. It's a bargain.